Hey there, everybody, and welcome to the NFL Road Show. Lindsay Rhodes here, still processing the way teams look in the wake of the draft. You know, we talk so much in the build-up to the draft about various guys and their skill sets, and we say all the time, you know, if this guy goes to the right spot as like a qualifier when we're talking about how good they can be in the NFL, well, now we know where they are going to play. So we're going to take stock of that in this episode. Guys who went to spots that are particularly good for them. Where they will have a chance to be the best version of themselves, perhaps. We're going to talk to Jim Nagy, who, as you know, is deep in the weeds of scouting as the director of the Reese's Senior Bowl. He's going to join me with five names that fit that bill as far as he's concerned. And Texans, Seahawks, Ravens, Cowboys, and Cardinals fans, you are going to particularly enjoy his analysis. But before we get to him, I came across a piece recently that Ben Solak had done for The Ringer about wide receiver talent. The headline was, "The NFL Draft Will Never Have a Bad Wide Receiver Class Again," which, A, is a very good headline. Yes, I would like to know more about that. Click. B, it's potentially hyperbolic. But C, it's also very interesting for a couple of different reasons. One, we just saw six receivers go in the first 18 picks in the 2022 draft, a draft that was generally agreed to be good, but did not have a surefire Ja'Marr Chase-like talent. And two, receiver contracts are blowing up. Tyreek getting $30 million a year and getting dealt as a result of wanting that money. AJ Brown traded to the Eagles because he also wanted a big contract and then got one in Philadelphia. Devontae Adams got paid. We're talking about a lot of money being allocated to the top wide receivers, obviously, which could complicate bookkeeping matters for teams that have a high-priced quarterback in particular. So if the headline is true, and we're going to see class after class of NFL-ready wide receivers, then that could, arguably should, have a major effect on roster-building strategy. Do you just rotate those guys through, like the running back model? Get a good rookie when his deal is up, maybe get a different good rookie. I think the implications are really interesting and certainly worth talking about. So Ben is here to do just that. From The Ringer and The Ringer NFL podcast, Ben Solak. Let's break the huddle.
Hello, let's go.
Two on two. Ready? Three.
So, Ben, receivers good for the rest of time in perpetuity, good draft classes. That's what we're going into.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody's worried, like, oh, the receiver market, all these veterans, they're going to get so much money. What do? Just draft receivers forever and it'll always work and never be bad. Go team.
And scene. What? Let's go back, because there are some things there that I think are sort of why I'm so intrigued, right? Because if we're looking at draft classes that are going to be good, then are we looking at like a new running back type thing where you just like flush them out after a few years and you never pay them because you can always get somebody else to come in? Is the wide receiver position different in a sense? There's a lot of different directions to go in off of this, but first let's start with why the statement was made in the first place about wide receiver drafts effectively going to be good for the next, you know, near future. What do you see about why that is?
Right. So it's a question of resources and economics, right? It's a question of what are we trying to do, not just in professional football, but in all the levels of football below it. Before I did like NFL coverage, I was doing draft coverage. So just year long, it was just, who's coming out, who might come out, who should maybe go back to school, whatever. And over the course of those years, you start to every single season, we get to January, February, hear this refrain of like, you know, it's a good receiver class this year. Yeah. And eventually you start to think, well, if they're all good receiver classes, kind of the Incredibles, right, with Syndrome, are they all the same? And what you realize is that they're all good receiver classes, not necessarily because this unique class is good and these unique players are good, but because the volume of players available at receiver has never been greater. And thereby there are just more good receivers being produced by high school and being produced by college by the law of big numbers. Right. And so in the high school ranks 20 years ago, you weren't throwing the football. Football was hard. You're running wing T nonsense. You're on triple option, right? This is the way we had to move the ball down the field because it was difficult to find a quarterback who could get that passing game working.
I mean, it might have been a little bit further back in 20 years.
Yeah, right, right. But, well, I'm thinking about where I grew up, which is literally like, I remember watching Pocono Mountain East beat us with a triple option every single year and being like, come on, guys, it's the 2010s. Let's move forward with our lives. But we struggled to throw the football. As rules changed, as offenses became more spread-oriented and figured out how to throw the ball in the short areas of the field and get yards after the catch, all of a sudden, high school receivers were getting more volume. And at the same time, concurrently, there's been the explosion of 7-on-7 football, which is spring high school football, no running, no contact. There's no injuries, which is critical. And it's all passing concepts against passing defenses. And this has created a huge environment for the development of skills for 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, who otherwise would have been triple option quarterbacks and wing T fullbacks. They have the ability to catch passes, get it on film, and then send it to colleges. And colleges have gotten a lot better at throwing the football and recruiting these quarterbacks and developing these quarterbacks. And so they get the ball to more receivers and now more body types, shorter players, thicker players, right? We had Treylon Burks out of Arkansas, built like a linebacker, 6'3", 230. He's playing receiver in the SEC because now we know how to get the ball to this player a little bit more easily. We know how to use yards after the catch, and he becomes more valuable to a passing offense as a receiver than he would to a defense as a linebacker. So there's just an explosion of people playing receiver. And as that happens, there's more cream to rise to the top. And every receiver class seems to have some really good first round picks.
Well, the opportunity part, let's start there. Cause it, what you say totally makes sense to me in terms of the passing leagues. It's like that whole outliers theory from Malcolm Gladwell about like the, what is it? 100,000 hours. I don't even know. Yeah, 10,000.
I think it is.
10,000. Okay.
If it's 100,000. I'm not as good at writing as I thought I was. Let's hope it's 10,000.
They're fucking dead by they make it to the NFL. They're like 80 years old. Okay. So 10,000 hours makes a lot more sense. Not good at math. So, and kind of like that all-star theory, right? Like the more reps that you get, if you're good early, then you get put in an all-star program, and then you're more likely to be better forever because you just are getting more and more and more experience. So the passing league thing does make a lot of sense to me, just in terms of reps. Is the separation then, do you have a separation at the top still? You know what I mean? Like, are you less likely to have a guy like last year's draft class? There was Jamar Chase. There was that elite can't miss. This year's draft class didn't really have that. Do you think that we're going to see more of like the pool of people that are acceptable is greater, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there will be these guys who will pop?
Yeah. So I think it's absolutely the pool of acceptable people will be greater. I think what we've seen is a rising tide in the second and third tiers, especially, right? We had 13 receivers go in the first two rounds of the 2022 class. It's a tied a record, right? And then 15 receivers went in the next five rounds. So the league was telling you, we like these couple of tiers, right? There were six in the first 18, Christian Watson at 34, and then there were six more from like 35 to 54. You know what I mean? Like they just all went a blitz. These are the tiers we like.
Yep.
And then after that, you know, we're going to get to pick our guys where we pick them, but we like everybody kind of above this line. So that pool of acceptable players, I think, is a good way of framing it. And then there will be stars because of the exact same theory. If there's a lot more people, then there's a lot more acceptable people. And if there's a lot more acceptable people, there's a better chance that one of them is freaking awesome. What I think is critical to understand is that won't always be the first receiver selected. Jamar Chase was recent. Jamar Chase had the best rookie receiver season we've seen ever, certainly in a doggone long time. He was the first receiver taken off the board. It's important to remember that was not 100%. We thought that would happen, but we didn't know that was going to happen coming into draft day. And if you go and you look at the classes beforehand, well, the best receiver was not the first receiver selected in those classes, right? In 2020, we have Henry Ruggs as the first receiver, and obviously his career took a left turn, but Justin Jefferson, who is the fifth receiver taken in that group, has clearly been the guy you would expect to be the best out of that group. 2019, Marquise Brown and N'Keal Harry were the first round picks. Then came DK Metcalf. Then came Deebo Samuel, right? So because there's a greater pool of acceptable people, it's more likely we get stars, more likely we get these elite players, these elite young rookie receivers. But we shouldn't believe we'll always be right in figuring out who that dude is in April. We're probably going to be wrong more than we're going to be right. And that goes back to the body types thing, right? Like Metcalf, an unbelievable receiver, runs three routes. Deebo Samuel, an unbelievable receiver, is a running back. We have found ways to make more different dudes work at receiver. So now there's more ways that the top guy is surprising to us and accordingly wasn't picked with that first receiver selection.
Do you think they still get better once they're selected in the league because of opportunity? Like if it's true at a younger age that you go into a passing league and you get more reps and therefore then you're going to get better and you're ahead of people who are not going to the passing leagues and getting those extra reps and they're only playing in the fall on their high school team or whatever. If you go to a team where the opportunity is greater earlier, do you actually think that there is room for them to become better still? Or do you think that we just know them as being good because we've had the opportunity to see them succeed?
Yes, they get better. And a lot of it is because NFL teams have more resources and better coaching to optimize the players. The two guys that immediately come to mind are Justin Jefferson and AJ Brown. Justin Jefferson played with Ja'Marr Chase, pretty good football player. And Terrace Marshall, who was a five-star recruit, was a second, maybe third-round pick for the Panthers, hasn't really panned out. But those guys were outside receivers. For Joe Burrow, who of all college quarterbacks said, if I get one-on-one on the outside, I'll take it. I do not care. I will test this corner. I will test this window. Sitting in the slot, running a seven-yard option route was Justin Jefferson, who now runs 35-yard posts, right? And always had that skill at LSU, but just offense didn't need it as much. They needed a good slot guy, good stick mover. Jefferson could do that very well. So a big part of the conversation with Jefferson coming out was, what will he look like transitioning to the outside? We don't really know. As opposed to CeeDee Lamb out of Oklahoma, we've seen it before. Jerry Jeudy, Henry Ruggs out of Alabama, we've seen it before. Lo and behold, if we had seen it at LSU, we probably would have known. But that opportunity for optimization, right? You get him in Minnesota where there's more room and there's more talent at offense, both on the team and the coaching staff, to get him in a better position, you see an explosion. AJ Brown was similar. DK Metcalf on one side, DeMarcus Lodge on the other side. They had outside receivers. Brown was a big slot. He was catching a six-yard curl route, breaking a tackle from a linebacker. If they could have had a quarterback and an offense at the SEC level that ran that play action, run that drift route, right, run that in-breaker the way the Titans have with AJ Brown, they would have done it. They couldn't really do that at Ole Miss. They didn't yet have the knowledge how it trickled down from the NFL. They didn't really have the quarterback. Put him in Tennessee, gave him Ryan Tannehill, who will throw that route till the cows come home. And all of a sudden you have AJ Brown, who's one of the best yak receivers in the league, catch balls 15 yards down the field. Perfect for what he does well. So in the NFL, we optimize a little better what our players can do. And that's why you can get star production out of guys you drafted as the sixth, seventh, eighth receiver.
The changes in acceptable body types that you mentioned earlier for wide receiver, how do you see that affecting the talent pool specifically? Like, do you see evidence that players that would have had to not had to play, I don't want to say that, but that would have played cornerback or would have been slotted to play cornerback or running back or something like that in the past, just because their body type said this is what that person is? Do you see evidence that suggests that those people are choosing to become wide receivers now, that the best athletes, so to speak, are becoming wide receivers, whereas they used to be a little bit more diversified?
Yeah, you do. Bill Connolly wrote a really good piece before the 2021 draft for ESPN about receivers taking over the NFL draft. And what he had that was really cool was recruiting data, where basically he just said, listen, in terms of the percentage of five stars and four stars, receivers have nearly doubled over the last 10 years. I think it was from like 10 to 22%, whereas there was about a 30% decrease in receivers. It went from, I want to say, like 18 to 14 or 18 to 12. You can find the piece. I can't remember the numbers. It's not like four star, like where the four stars came from changed, right? It's not like the number of them changed. You were watching as a 5'10", 180 pound dude, Tyreek Hill dominate for the Chiefs. And then you were saying, I look like that guy. I'm built like that guy. I'd like to play like that guy. You probably aren't as fast as that guy, but whatever. You're a high school kid. You believe you can be. That's fine. You now want to play receiver. You're asking your coach.
DK believes that he is as fast.
Yeah, right. Anyway. So you're now asking your coach to play receiver. You're putting more film out of you playing receiver. And colleges want to put you at receiver because in the past, when we had a really good athlete, right? Like you see in high school recruiting, oh, he's a four-star athlete. We didn't really give him a position. That guy is just like a guy you want to get the ball to, right? And so accordingly, we put him at quarterback or running back because that's where the easy touches happen. Ball snapped to the quarterback. You can just put it right in the running back's belly. He now has the ball. So this four-star athlete has the ball. That's what we wanted. When the Chiefs brought in Mecole Hardman, or excuse me, the Georgia Bulldogs brought in Mecole Hardman from high school. Four-star athlete, played quarterback, played cornerback. They put him at receiver. And it's because it's easier now to get the ball in the receiver's hands than it ever was. Bubble screens, RPOs, jet touches. We have found ways to just give the ball to athletes and call them receivers instead of calling them running backs. And then they get developmental opportunities to actually run routes. And so we're seeing that recruiting shift push towards those players because now we don't have to call them running backs and line them up in the backfield to give them free touches behind the line of scrimmage.
It's funny because you talk about how recruiting, they used to call them athletes, and now they're getting plugged into positions. I almost feel like in the NFL, it's flipping. Like a Debo is the perfect example of somebody who is just a weapon, quote unquote. Like, I don't feel the need to label him. There are a million different ways that
he calls himself a wide back, which does not roll off the tongue, and he needs to work on it. But that's what he calls himself.
But ultimately, like, he's everything, you know, which is the beauty of him, which is why everybody's looking for the next Debo. Good luck with that. From a developmental standpoint, if the passing leagues and the extra opportunities are leading to more talent at the wide receiver position, if that's at least one of the factors there, why aren't we seeing more good quarterbacks coming out, do you think?
I think I would say net we are. I know that's a tough thing to say after this last draft. It was not a good draft for quarterbacks. Took it on the chin there a little bit. I think net we are, but I will say that one of the reasons why we're still seeing good quarterbacks drafted, and I think I can say that with confidence that we are seeing better quarterbacks, is because the league has become more comfortable with these simple offenses that are run in college. Whereas 5-10 years ago, air raid quarterback was a pejorative. Now we're more okay with that idea, right? And so the offenses in college got more spready. They got more RPO-y. They got more simple. They took thinking out of the quarterback's head. And they just got the ball to playmakers. They just got the ball to receivers. This leads to great development in receivers. But there was that moment there, you know, in the 2010s, kind of coming out with a guy like Gardner Minshew, coming out with even Patrick Mahomes, who had his questions of like, how much can we trust these guys running these RPO offenses, running these air raid offenses? And it seems like the league has gotten over that hump a little bit to the point where they're saying, you know what? We're going to have to develop these guys. We're going to have to coach these guys up. There are four offenses in college right now where if you run that offense, you can come to the NFL and run our offenses. It's just we have to accept the fact that there's development that has to happen there so that the scale has shifted a little bit. The grading curve has shifted a little bit. Quarterbacks are running simpler offenses, and that may make us feel like they're not as good of prospects, but the league has accepted that that's the reality, and the league has also found ways to run those simple offenses, right? If we're going to talk about like an NFL-esque program in college, we're going to talk about Alabama. Guess what they were running for Tua in 2019? It was RPOs. It was quick game. It was everything the Dolphins are doing now, which is like cheesy stuff at the NFL level, but it's what you have to do for this quarterback. And so the league has kind of bridged that gap in terms of expecting their quarterbacks to be these precise pocket-managing, game-managing pocket passers.
So then what should the Dolphins do to best maximize Tua? How should they prioritize that in your opinion? Because they also have other weapons that can do more things that his skill set might not be best suited for, i.e. the social media clip that
I feel so bad for Buddy who had to post that video. He was editing it. He knew. He did his best to try to hide it. I don't know that he knew. No, that like herky jerkiness right when the ball was caught. I feel like he was trying his best to like hide it a little bit.
But why post it? So what we're talking about here is there was a clip of Tua throwing deep to Tyreek. Exactly. And it follows the ball in the air and it's this pretty spiral. And then at the end, Tyreek has to kind of reach behind him to grab it.
Yeah.
So it's underthrown.
Yeah. They're building it the correct way. This is appropriate. Mike McDaniel, to have a diverse running game that's going to allow you to get into easier play action and RPO ideas. Tyreek Hill and Debo Samuel, who delightful downfield receivers. Debo, excellent intermediate receiver, but two of the best guys with the ball in their hands. We talk about these scheme touches behind the line of scrimmage. Both of those guys are going to be valuable. Excuse me, not Debo Samuel, Jalen Waddle, who hopes to be the Debo Samuel for the Miami Dolphins. So two players who are incredible in that regard. Yeah, this is the right way to build it. It doesn't feel good. And that's part of why, you know, Miami's certainly regretting the quarterback they took at 5 instead of Herbert, who went at 6, and probably it will continue to be in the quarterback market moving forward, because you feel internally that this is a offense we might be able to win with, but we're not going to win because of it. We're going to skate by with it. And that's not where you want to be if you have playoff aspirations. And so this is the right way to build it. They have done an appropriate job in understanding the limitations of their quarterback, where that means their investments must go and where they must, you know, kind of cut some corners. We will see how successful they can be with it. But to me, it's a very narrow road to walk.
So I think for many of the reasons that you just said, I think that it was the right decision to go pay Tyreek. because not only are you being forced to kind of create some offense where there might not otherwise be because of the quarterback position, it's also he gives you a really good opportunity to evaluate the quarterback so that you know whether or not you need to move on from this investment or to invest further.
Absolutely. But
I do think that the Tyreek getting paid thing goes back to the original point of this, which is, are we going to continue to see that? Are teams going to continue to pay guys like Tyreek these massive contracts? Maybe there will always be teams like this that just need that, or whether or not there's going to be this new model of developing wide receivers, bring them in, or not developing, I guess, bringing in a wide receiver, drafting them, playing them on their rookie deal, and then just flush repeat before they pay them a massive contract. Based on what you've said about the future of wide receivers in the draft, do you think that that's maybe a direction that we might be headed?
In a way. So the running back idea is a very crystal clear one. Running backs get a lot of volume. They get hit a lot. Getting hit a lot makes your age cliff get a little bit shorter, right? You're more likely to start getting hurt and start depreciating athletically earlier than other positions that don't get hurt as much. So don't get hit as much. So running backs feel a little bit more fragile. And then in terms of our understanding of running game from an X's and O's perspective and from an analytics perspective, we understand that while a running back's talent affects the running game, it is more drastically affected by the talent of the offensive line and what the blocking system is doing in front of that running back. So we can more easily cycle out replacement level players at running back, young, cheap guys, keep our line healthy, keep our line well paid, keep our line talented, and we expect to run the football pretty well. That a lot of that feels like it can be true at receiver. Let's go get a good quarterback, which is like the good offensive line. Let's keep him healthy. Let's keep him well-paid, right? Star quarterback. We know that receivers can get soft tissue injuries, and we know that we can get production a bunch of different ways, right? We talked about all those different body types. There's a myriad of systems that we can use. We can go yards after the catch. We can go downfield, contested catch, jump ball, whatever. So let's cycle in constant new guys. Let's never overpay at this position. So those ideas feel analogous, and to a degree they are. I think that you saw smart teams, Ravens, the Packers, the Chiefs, all decide to say, hey, we're going to go cheaper at the receiver position. What's critical in terms of the difference, which will make or break kind of the way we think about receivers over the next 5-10 years, is that the passing offense is more important than the running offense writ large, right?
Right.
If you could be good at one thing, you'd be good at throwing the ball. Throwing the ball is explosives. Throwing the ball is conversions on third downs. That is a better prediction of overall offensive success and team success than the running game. You want both. But if you had to pick one, you'd want to be better at passing. And so this, you know, work being cheap at the running back position, this work at moving away from the running game, passing more on early downs, being a higher pass team, makes sense because passing matters the most. Well, are we going to then go cheap at receiver? If the passing offense is really what we love and it's how we want to live in the modern NFL, that's another step further beyond that running back comparison. So that to me is the critical difference. I think that you will see teams with star quarterbacks, as we saw with Rodgers, Mahomes, and Lamar, say that, all right, we have a limited cap. We have a limited amount of money to spend. We have a hard cap. We have to cut corners somewhere. We probably can get away with cheaper receivers because our quarterback's just that good, right? We have the ability to get that done. With the Packers, it's kind of weird because like Rodgers is old, and also is Aaron Rodgers at any time could just like leave. But for like Mahomes and Lamar, cool, I get it. So I think we'll see that while we see teams like the Cardinals, the Dolphins, the Eagles, who have young quarterbacks that are trying to figure out just how big of a second contract do we want to give this guy? They're going to go get that star receiver so that they can really see what their quarterback looks like with talented pass catchers, get a proof of concept on his passing ability. But for the star teams with the star quarterbacks, I think we will see the receiver position become a little bit more 1 year, 10 million, 2 year, 25 million, the way you saw with Marquez Valdes-Scantling and Juju Smith-Schuster and some of these alternative options, because hey, we have Mahomes. Our passing game can only be so bad. We can get a little bit cheaper receiver.
And if you have a quarterback that you have question marks about, go ahead and pay up.
Yeah, absolutely. Like AJ Brown to the Eagles is the best example. He's 24 and he's a proven NFL star. He also is amazing over the middle of the field, which is where Jalen Hurts has not liked throwing the ball at the NFL level. So let's go get AJ Brown. We have Hurts right now to contract. If Hurts is going to be a good enough passer to win a playoff game, because the Bucs in the wild card round just did not respect his arm at all, period. It was just, they had no interest in pretending to defend the Eagles passing game. They didn't care about it. So if Hurts is ever going to become that guy, Brown is the sort of receiver he'd need. So let's give him Brown. And now he's got a year to show us he can throw middle of the field and he can develop as a passer. If not, we still have AJ Brown. He's 25 years old. It was only $54 million guaranteed on the deal. It's like a healthy receiver deal, but relative to Brandon Cooks and Christian Kirk. It's not outlandish. And we're going to go get our new guy, our rookie, and we're going to have a star 25-year-old receiver to develop him. So that's a perfect example of when you have quarterback uncertainty, star receiver becomes, I think, a little bit more important than for those teams who have quarterback certainty.
Do you think we've seen enough from AJ Brown to know that he's worth it?
I do. I love AJ Brown to death. I think AJ Brown's a ludicrously talented receiver. That Titans Niners primetime game, I want to say it was like week 12, week 13. That'll stick in my mind for a long time. Debo versus Brown going punch for punch. Those are defining games to me for those two players. Brown has the red flag for Brown is the injury thing. I said that running backs get hit more than receivers. The way AJ Brown plays, AJ Brown gets hit a little bit. AJ Brown takes those middle of the field throws. AJ Brown's a big physical guy. And so Brown has been banged up. And that's your concern if you're Philadelphia, as you made this investment in a player who may not be a 17 game a year player. And that's always a little bit touchy. But for me, I love AJ Brown. I love what he plays. I think he's a star.
Obviously, we're moving in a direction where analytics are kind of factoring into everything and front offices are surely using numbers to make these decisions. Do you think this becomes like a wins above replacement, or how do you think they determine whether or not a wide receiver ultimately is that guy that, because it's not just an eye test thing anymore. It's not like that guy's really good, so let's pay him. You know, what do you think? How do you think we make that determination about who is special enough that we can afford to invest in you? And who is like not different enough from the next crop of guys?
Right.
More than
absolutely
likely.
No idea. That's the most difficult question. You know what I mean? And that's the reality. I think the thing that I see the most impact in terms of how analytics is changing the receiver position in the passing game is this idea of target distributions, target heat maps. Where can our quarterback throw the football? Right. We have factors like time to throw. How long can he hang in the pocket until he's going to get hit? And what does he do when pressure comes? Is he an escape guy or is he a get rid of the ball quickly guy? What is his arm strength like, right? Like Joe Burrow is the man. He played in the Super Bowl for the AFC. Doesn't have great arm strength, but they found ways to get the ball deep outside for explosive gains by throwing the ball very quickly. Time to throw. And we're going to let Burrow hit that deep ball now instead of waiting an extra beat because he's not Josh Allen. He's not Patrick Mahomes. He's not Justin Herbert. He can't make that throw. So we see an understanding of how numbers can tell us where a quarterback throws the football and how they're throwing the football there, right? Jimmy Garoppolo throwing middle of the field constantly in rhythm, quickly, in time, because he's just a system quarterback. He just likes to be that robot, just execute, execute, execute. So as those funnels help us to find play styles, those play styles can point us at the right receivers, right? I said that Jalen Hurts does not like to throw middle of the field. The Eagles got the best middle of the field receiver in the world. To me, that very clearly says we need to find out if our quarterback can do this. In Arizona, we have Kyler Murray get Marquise Brown. That's not we don't know if Kyler can throw deep down the field vertical. That's we like throwing deep down the field vertical. And we need to inform this decision. We need to get better on offense by getting a speedster, getting an elite downfield receiver like they believe Marquise Brown to be. And so I think that in terms of analytics, the thing that I see the most repercussions in is play style, target distribution. What sort of offense do we want to be? In terms of the magic numbers that tell us if a receiver is good or not, I would love for them to exist. Make my job a lot easier. Stop watching film, click some buttons. I know who's good or not, but it's tough.
Did you go on a rant recently about analytics? Did I just bring up analytics to an anti-analytics?
It was a fake rant. So on the Ringer NFL Draft Show, which I did with Danny Kelly, Danny Heifetz, and Craig Horlbeck, that's our fantasy football team. They do an episode a year called The Take Purge, where for an hour, it's like the Purge movies, like the siren goes off. You can say anything you want, no repercussions. And every year we do the draft cycle, and I just like a film guy. And the nerds are always like, hey,
the nerds
just only draft quarterbacks and don't draft any other positions and always trade back. And like, yes, those are generally good guardrails, but to me, there's always exceptions and there's always nuance and color. And so one of my takes, for which I am not responsible, Lindsay, and I can't,
because it was the Purge.
Yes, because the Take Purge was get the nerds out of my football. And I didn't mean it, and I love many nerds, but yes, there it is.
You're awesome. I want to ask you really quick about this year's wide receiver class. All the things that we said, who do you think is most set up to succeed?
Yeah, so I like Treylon Burks, and it is a good summation of everything we've talked about. He landed in a place with a ton of volume in Tennessee. No Julio Jones, no more AJ Brown. He had that build that was similar to AJ Brown coming out of the SEC. 6'2", 6'3", 220, 225. Unbelievable explosiveness in a short area, right? Burks didn't run the 40 a lot of people were expecting, but watch the 10-yard split. Watch him go from 0 to 60 against LSU, against Ole Miss. some impressive film in terms of that short area burst, which is a lot of what makes Deebo Samuel a difficult player to tackle. NFL defenders are accustomed to seeing a guy of a certain size and going, he can only move so fast. And Deebo and Burks have that thing where they just go. There's on top of you now. And it surprises you. They get on you, and then you have to tackle them with half a shoulder instead of a full shoulder. And those boys are big. It's tough to get away with those little margins. And so he has that explosiveness. He has that physicality. And he has that size to work that same AJ Brown role. At Arkansas in the SEC, he didn't really have that role. They weren't trying to throw those routes as much. They weren't trying to ask their quarterback to throw middle of the field. Those are tough throws. In Tennessee, it's Ryan Tannehill. Tannehill loves throwing middle of the field. Tannehill will sit in the pocket, take a hit, and throw that ball, 18-yard dig, like I said, until the cows come home. And so to me, that's a really nice marriage of opportunity, of role, of the skills kind of fitting that we talked about, the talents fitting the traits. Like everything is there for Burks to, I think, be really, really successful. If you had asked any Treylon Burks fan, of which I was one before draft, what's the one place he should go? Like, oh, Tennessee. Perfect offense for him. And there he is. So I believe in Burks to be productive early.
And it's the perfect example of what we're talking about here too, mm-hmm. about potentially moving on from somebody who is looking at a big money deal and plugging in a guy who does similar things potentially.
Yep.
And paying them a lot less.
Yeah. And you get to find out, is Ryan Tannehill a guy who can win playoff games for us? Because that's been a question. They've made it to the playoffs. Haven't won a lot of playoff games. And you also get a young player to potentially develop with Malik Willis. The Titans did a really good job of just very quietly getting ready for the next cycle, not just the next year, but the next era of Titans football in this draft. I thought it was a very sneaky rebuild draft and an impressive one because it required a lot of honesty with their team and where they were at and what their reality was. So good draft by them. I think Burks will be good.
Good stuff by you, Ben. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. I had a good time. Thanks for bringing me on.
And you can find Ben's work at theringer.com, also the Ringer NFL Show podcast, and at his Twitter handle at Benjamin Solak. And yes, I noted all the points that he made about Burks in that Titans offense for fantasy purposes. Those rookie drafts are going to be here before we know it. And I feel like the receivers this year, the rookie receivers, are more grouped together than they've been in recent years. Different styles, different opportunities. I'm finding it hard to find a differentiator that I feel really strongly about. Like a guy whose skill set mixed with the opportunity present is way better than one of the other guys. So I'm intrigued by the things that he said about Burks. I'm also eager to hear what our next guest has to say about that subject matter. Jim Nagy, executive director of the Reese's Senior Bowl, knows the players, and now he knows where they will be playing. Five guys in a position to pop. Coming up next.
Hi, everyone. This is Hall of Fame sportscaster Leslie Visser. After 45 years of covering everything in sports, I've been lucky to know some of the greatest personalities, storytellers, and legends. And I bring it all to my podcast, In Conversation with Leslie Visser. You'll hear from coaches, players, authors, and celebrities like Kansas City Chiefs superfan Eric Stonestreet.
There are a few immediate yeses, and talking to you was an immediate yes.
New episodes come out every Thursday. I hope you'll listen and subscribe wherever you stream your podcasts.
Jim, hi. Appreciate your time as always.
Yeah, good to be back on, Lindsay. Can't believe we're finally through it.
I know. Yay. So you actually, our last conversation was all the way back in December, proved to be pretty valuable to me post-draft in terms of, at the very least, providing some context for the Bears pick of Velus Jones and what they might have been thinking by taking him there. Because there were a lot of fans there in Chicago that seemed to be caught off guard. Did that pick make sense to you?
It did, because they need playmakers. You know, if you're talking about, you know, supporting a young quarterback, which I feel like that's the narrative for every team with a young quarterback. We got to build around the quarterback. We got to give the guy weapons. So that's obviously what Ryan Poles was trying to do in his first draft. And if you take a guy 71 overall, you obviously have a plan for him. It's not like they didn't draft Velus just to come in and be the return specialist. So they've got a plan for him on offense, and he can, as we talked about back in December, he's so good with the ball in his hands. So hopefully they'll be creative with him.
It feels like that's the more that I talk about the Bears draft and the pick of Velus, the fact that they so desperately needed offensive playmakers. Like they have Darnell Mooney, but is he a one, you know, like, so you need to put some people around Justin Fields so you can get an evaluation of him. And as you mentioned, that's a conversation we're having relatively frequently about these young quarterbacks. The fact that where they were looking to take a wide receiver, you know, you could have taken a Tolbert, perhaps. Maybe that would have been a better, like, X number one potential type wide receiver. But it feels to me like it makes sense to plug in a Velus because of the versatility that it gives you. If you are just devoid of offensive weapons to a degree, then maybe he can do more things for you. He's more of a Swiss Army knife, and maybe there's value in that. Is he that guy? Because I know that you brought up the Deebo comp, and not to say that he is a comp to Deebo, but more of like that type of guy that people could use if they wanted to create a Deebo-like role on their team. What types of things do you see him actually doing to follow through on that comp for the Bears?
Yeah, it was more just the usage, Lindsay. And again, I think what any team that drafts a player and expects them to get on the field year one and be versatile, you better dig deep into the player's mental acumen and how much he can pick it up, because it's hard to be a rookie in that league, especially when you're throwing multiple positions at a guy. So I'm sure the Bears, you know, kind of did a deep dive and with the Tennessee staff and with Velus himself to figure out, okay, like we're going to have him, we're going to be, you know, playing him in the backfield some, we're going to be, you know, doing a lot of things to get him the ball, you know, in the run game, pass game. Like, that's a lot on a young guy. So I'm sure they did their homework there. And then I do think the return stuff was kind of probably a difference maker when you're looking at a couple of receivers on the board, because it's not, Velus can do punts and kicks equally as good. I mean, the guy was all American level guy in both phases. So he will affect that phase of the game. And then on offense, yeah, it's a playmaker, and where the Deebo comp is really the run strength. Velus is strong with the ball in his hands. He is a big, thick, put together guy. And he's fast. We know that. He was, the second fastest wide out of the combine this year, running 4.31, but it was more so the run strength. But yeah, I would anticipate them incorporating him in a lot of different ways.
Well, the Bears, congratulations to you, because the Bears have acknowledged that pretty much where he popped up onto their radar, where they got a lot of work done on him and a lot of other players in their draft class, was down there at Senior Bowl there in Mobile. So he's one guy that I'm going to put on my radar to kind of keep an eye on during training camp, and then maybe try to grab in a later round in a fantasy draft, just because the potential for opportunity is there. Who are some people that jump out at you, having evaluated this whole class, that you think ended up in situations that will bring out the best in them? Like, there are some guys that we knew were going to be good. They're probably going to be good wherever they go, unless it's a terrible situation. There are some guys who I think you probably will end up liking more post-draft than you even did pre-draft, because the opportunity will be there for them to be their best selves.
Absolutely. There's a bunch of great fits. And we can talk about a bunch of guys, Lindsay, but I think, you know, I had this conversation with a few players during draft weekend, guys that were getting antsy and texting me about when they were going to go. And, you know, I just tried to tell them, players don't want to hear this. They want to go as early as possible, but it's really more important where you go than when you go. You certainly don't want to fall like three rounds past where you thought you were going to go. But if it's close, if it's like a round, and you end up in a much better situation, to me, that's, you got to think long-term. And I understand players are thinking in the immediacy, but I would start, and we can bounce around to some different players, but I would probably start in Arizona with Trey McBride, you know, the first tight end off the board from Colorado State, Mackey Award winner. I just think he went into a great situation. If you look at Arizona right now, they've got DeAndre Hopkins is going to start the year suspended. You know, they lost Christian Kirk to the Jacksonville Jaguars. They traded for Hollywood Brown, so there's a new piece. Mm-hmm. I get it that he and Kyler played college ball together, but that's a new piece in the offense. And then they got Rondale Moore. And then you've got Zach Ertz at tight end. So I think you could see a lot more two tight end stuff coming out initially, at least while Hopkins is out. And that will give Trey a great opportunity to get on the field early. And again, I think it's a great opportunity for the Cardinals to maybe come out early in the season with a bunch of different looks that people haven't seen on tape in the past.
That's an interesting point.
Really been a wide receiver heavy pass game, because they really haven't had a second tight end, you know, especially last year. And now you bring McBride and Ertz out there, and they're similar. I think Trey, if you're just looking at it from Trey's perspective, he's a similar guy to Zach. I mean, he can watch Zach's tape and probably, you know, mold his game a little bit. And then everyone knows what a pro Zach is, so he'll learn under a guy that knows how to be a pro. So I think that's just a really good fit for Trey McBride in Arizona.
Those are all really good points there. Should we take this to mean that Max Williams might not be long for Arizona, in your opinion? Because obviously he is there also recovering from an injury, might not be ready for the start of the season. But that would give them three wide receivers that, and I know they think highly of Max. They've called him the complete tight end and raved about his game.
Sure, sure. He's a good combo tight end. But I think when you draft a guy up in the second round like Trey McBride, you've got a plan for him. I mean, you have to see that guy getting on the field. And again, I think the nice thing for Trey, he was the offense at Colorado State. You know, there was the one game, he was our Senior Bowl Player of the Week one week, and I forget who they played, but I'd never seen a stat line like it in my life. He had 109 of the 110 receiving yards for Colorado State that week.
What?
Yes.
109 of 110?
Yeah. I don't know who got the other yard, Lindsay, but he had. So I guess what it says is Trey's used to being the offense. Like, he was Colorado State's offense. He's used to being focused on. He's used to drawing double coverage and all the attention. So now he's out on a football field with guys like Zach Ertz and Rondale Moore and Hollywood Brown. He's not going to be getting any of that. He's going to be out there single covered. He's not going to know what to do with himself. So it's going to be like a whole new lease on life for Trey, just not getting all that extra attention. So I would think, even though Max is still there, I think they would have to have a plan for Trey to get him on the field right away.
Now, assuming that there are some people that are listening that aren't as familiar with, you know, the different players coming out of college and their strengths and weaknesses and stuff. I'm sure some Cardinals fans have read the fact that the Cardinals said that his comp is a little bit more similar to Max Williams than Zach Ertz. Max Williams is somebody that I think of more of like the strength is run blocking and what he brings to the game all the way around. Not that he can't operate within the passing game, but he has not been a prolific, you know, passing tight end, receiving tight end, I guess would be the way to put that.
Yeah.
That is different than Trey. Why do you think that they see the comp as being more similar to Max?
Well, I didn't do Max when he was coming out of college. That was back when I was in Seattle scouting for the Seahawks. I didn't do him, so I'm not really familiar with him. I do know Ertz a little better. And I just think just because of the pass game stuff, the athlete, the body type, the size, the measurables, I think are very similar. They both have a really good feel in the pass game. So I see that. I don't know Max as well. They know their roster better than I do. But I just think Trey is ready to get on the field right away and help you in the pass game. He's just a really accomplished guy in that phase of the game. And even though he is only like 6'3" and a half, 250 pounds, he's got enough fight in him to play on the line of scrimmage as maybe a backside blocker. I don't think he's ever going to be like that big bodied wide tight end that just moves people off the line, but he is scrappy. He will, you know, he'll get up on linebackers and safeties and he'll do enough as a blocker. But to me, you draft Trey McBride in the second round, you draft him to be a threat in the pass game.
I love it. I love the point too about throwing a little bit more too tight and just to mix things up so that people don't know what's coming at the beginning of the season. That feels like something Kingsbury can do to freshen up that offense, which I think is something he should be looking to do this offseason. Is there a wide receiver that you think went to a particularly good situation where their value kind of increases as a result?
Well, you brought him up, Jalen Tolbert, which is funny. He and Velus are both Mobile area guys. We had six players from Mobile drafted, Lindsay, in the first 126 picks, which is insane. For a little community our size, to have six guys go in the top, you know, the top four rounds was amazing. But I think Jalen Tolbert, I really thought Jalen could go in the second. You know, hearing what I've heard coming out of Dallas, that was the debate in the second round was either Sam Williams, the pass rusher from Ole Miss, or Jalen. They were considering him there. They kind of felt like they had a better chance of Jalen falling to the 88th pick. So they went with Sam. And it was one of those things on draft day. When I talk to my friends around the league going into the draft, all I say is, I hope it falls your way. And that one completely fell Dallas's way. So they end up with Jalen Tolbert, who obviously Michael Gallup, CeeDee Lamb are the top two guys. They've got a really good starting pair there. But they need a third guy. A lot of times you're not going to bank on a rookie to get up to speed and be that three right away. I think Jalen can do that. And I just say that because he's been here in Mobile at South Alabama. I've been watching him since high school, really developed a relationship with Jalen. He's been in our office. He's watched tape on this screen a bunch, getting ready for this past season. So like from a maturity standpoint, he is a pro. Like, he's been preparing like a pro. He went down to Tampa last summer and worked out with Randy Moss and Yo Murphy and all those guys that train in Tampa together. So this guy's going to hit the ground running. He's going to get to Dallas. He's going to hitch his wagons to CD and Michael Gallup and learn from those guys. And the other great thing is he's got a cool relationship with Dak Prescott already. Like Dak's already reached out to him. So I really think there's a plan there for Jalen to be the three right away.
South Alabama's all-time leading receiver averaged 17.8 yards per catch in his last 3 years of college. Obviously has a lot of speed too with that 4.4 time from the testing leading up to the draft. Where do you see him playing on the field primarily? Is he an outside guy? Is he a guy that you can move into the slot? What's his game?
Well, and that's one of the great things Jalen brings to the table. And that was a big thing for him coming back to school. He almost left as a junior. They were going through a coaching change at the time, and agents were circling. The vultures were circling. I say that to my agent friends. You guys aren't vultures, but they were circling Jalen pretty good two Decembers ago. And South Alabama brought him back, and part of the sales pitch was bringing in Major Applewhite to be the offensive coordinator. And Major was coming from Alabama, where he had been on the staff with Steve Sarkisian, and they did such a good job 2 years ago moving Devontae Smith around and getting him the ball and being creative when Jalen Waddle went down. That's what they did with Jalen Tolbert this year at South Alabama. He had really just been, he'd been locked in at one position his whole career. This year, he showed the ability mentally to move around. I mean, they just did everything they could do with the guy. They moved him outside in the slot, motioned him, used him in the run game. So he will be good to go. And I think he is a guy that they plan on moving around. He can definitely do that. If one of those guys goes down, they can plug him in as a starter at either X or Z. And then if he's the third guy, he can play in the slot.
Just use all the Jalens the same.
That's right.
Don't have to look that far for the comps. What about a running back? Is there a running back that, because I feel like the running backs are really interesting, right? In the draft, you've got like Breece Hall, who was the consensus number one back coming out, goes to a situation in New York that I know some people think is going to be a good situation for him. It was confusing to me because of Michael Carter. And I thought Michael Carter looked pretty good last year. So now you're putting two people in the backfield from a fantasy standpoint. It's a nightmare. That's not what we were looking for at all. It was more confusion. But is there a running back that you think went to a particularly good situation?
Yeah, I would say Damian Pierce from Houston. Mm. And I tweeted that out in the middle of the draft when they made the pick. I think that was my favorite pick of the draft up to that point. Getting Damian in the fourth round to me was incredible value because I do think he's a three down starter. He was one of those guys at Florida, just didn't get a ton of touches. I want to say maybe 80 carries, something really limited this year. But again, I'm not even faulting that Florida coaching staff. I know that when we were hyping up Damian coming into Senior Bowl week and everything here, I read a lot of Florida fan-based stuff, and they were taking shots at Dan Mullen and that previous staff on why they didn't use him more. Hey, in the day of the portal and trying to keep players happy, I get it. Like, college coaches got to spread out touches. So, I mean, the good thing is from an NFL perspective, if I were in a draft room, that would have been one of the things I harped on is how much tread this guy's got left on his tire. He was not used up at Florida at all. But he's a three down starter. He's going to go in there. I think Rex Burkhead, is an established guy. He's been with Nick Caserio in New England, but he's going to be the third down guy primarily, I would think. Mm-hmm. I think Damian's got a really good chance to be that first and second down starter. And then he can pass protect. He's good at that. He showed that at the Senior Bowl. He can catch it out of the backfield. He might not be the most dynamic guy as a receiver, but he's an NFL runner. When you watch him on contact and just his lower body power and ability to see things and bounce off contact, like, I think he's got a chance to be, he's got a really good chance to be their starter right out of the gate week one.
They've got Marlon Mack that they brought in this year. This is a guy who could beat him out, in your opinion?
Yeah, they're different runners. Marlon's more top end speed. He's coming off injury. Marlon's been a good back. I think Marlon's thing is just staying healthy. Again, that's probably going to be a good battle in camp. I just think that of the rookie runners, Damian's got a really good shot right there. And if you're just looking fantasy wise, again, Marlon's a guy that with a little bit of durability concern, at some point, I think Damian's going to see the field quite a bit.
You this is a full sidebar, but you brought up something I think is really interesting from a college game standpoint. And everyone's talked about the portal and how frustrating it is that, you know, these guys can leave at any minute, or some people have been frustrated, I guess, and looked at it that way. From a coaching standpoint, is that something that you're hearing, that they have to constantly effectively like constantly recruit and make football decisions based on playing time in order to maintain their roster? It's an interesting way of looking at it. I hadn't really thought about that. You can't necessarily just sit there and put your best guys out there in a way that you think would put you in a position to win the game the most, because you have to think about retention also.
Yeah, it's really complicating things for college coaches. I know a lot of guys that are really wanting to make the jump to the NFL for that reason. It's just
coaches.
College coaches, right? Because again, like the recruiting thing has always been a little bit of a rat race, right? Like recruiting's difficult. I mean, you're on the road a ton. Those college guys, like they really earn their keep, man. Like I don't, whatever money they're making, they probably deserve more at most of these schools for the amount of hours they have to put in. But it used to be you're just recruiting high school kids. Now you're really recruiting your entire roster on a daily basis. And you're on the whims. You're at the whims of an 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old kid who, you know, if he goes into the spring game and he doesn't get the run that he thinks he should get, now he's in the portal. So, I mean, it's a daily challenge. And I think with Damian, just maybe specific to Damian, knowing what people at Florida think of him and in our experience with him in the Senior Bowl and what a great dude this guy is, like his energy level, you want him in your locker room. Like I even called the guys at Florida. I actually went to Florida. I went and spoke to the team at Florida a little bit after our game. And I asked him, I'm like, was he the same guy in this building as he was in Mobile for a week? Because like his energy level was off the charts. And they're like, oh yeah, that's him every day. That's Damian. But so if you have a guy, if you have a guy like that, who's going to accept his role and be a good teammate and be a good program guy, you know, that's maybe why he wasn't the full-time starter there, because maybe, and I'm not saying specific to this case, but say maybe you have another guy that would be tend to be more disgruntled or a little more high maintenance. You might just play that guy a little more because, you know, Damian's going to play his role and be a good teammate and be happy with it. So it's just those, you know, it's managing those egos and touches, and it's really made it difficult on these college coaches.
And then where's the line, right? Like where you, cause you want to keep people getting reps, so that they're happy, because you need the people on your team in order to field team. But then where's the line in terms of production and value added, before there's a drop off, so that you're actually hurting your ability to win games, which is ultimately the main, I mean, it just feels completely confusing. And like you said, I you couldn't pay me enough money. I mean, no one's asking me to, but like to be a college coach anyway, because of how hard and the constant recruiting of high school players. Now that you factor in the constant recruiting, it just feels like there are no days off, right? Like a full Bill Belichick over there.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So that's a wide receiver, a running back, and a tight end. We're hitting up the skill position players. That's three. Let's do a couple more guys. How about on the offensive line? Are there any people who jump out at you?
Yeah, I would look to my old place in Seattle in terms of fit, really, for both players and for the organization. They've been, you know, I was part of it. We were trying to figure out the offensive line for a lot of years there. And I think they found their bookends. I really did. With Charles Cross from Mississippi State in the first round, who is really probably the most NFL ready pass protector in this draft, coming from Mike Leach's offense. Now, sure, some of the run game stuff is going to be a little work in progress. But if you're talking about protecting Drew Lock and giving Drew Lock a chance to be successful this year,
are we talking about that?
Hey, that's a separate.
It's Drew. That's the story. We're sticking with it. It's Drew.
It is. It's going to be Drew. Drew. And then on the right side, you know, Abe Lucas from Washington State, who was a right tackle his whole time there at Washington State, in the third, bouncing back in the third round and getting a guy that a lot of people, myself, I thought he'd go in the second. And they've got two young guys. They've got Stone Forsythe, who was a sixth round pick a year ago, plugged in at left tackle. So Charles Cross, obviously you're taking him in the top 10. You think that's going to be your starter. And then on the right side, they started a few games last year with another rookie, Jake Curran, who was an undrafted guy last year, senior bowler who made their team and started some games. So now you've got a third rounder who's got to beat out an undrafted rookie, and that, you know, that's going to be a battle. I mean, Pete will open that up and they'll compete that thing out. But really coming out of this draft, Seattle could have their two bookend tackles of the future for the next, you know, 6, 7, 8 years. And that's a much better spot to be in from the Seattle Seahawks standpoint than they've been in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years.
From your lips to God's ears, man, just like fingers crossed there for Seattle. Two questions there. Or Charles Cross, the fact that he is a good pass protector is going to be obviously very welcomed, as that is an area that they have just been awful in. But Charles Cross, the run game stuff is obviously a priority there for Seattle. So if you're Seattle, or you, if you're you looking at it from a Seattle prism, how do you balance, you know, when you're trying to make a decision about a guy to draft, which to prioritize there? Because clearly the run blocking is massively important, because that's what you want to do the majority of the time, but you have to get better in pass pro.
Right. And that's going to be their identity. And that's what Pete has really always wanted to be their identity, is running the football. And that's why they took Kenneth Walker from Michigan State in the second round. They've got Chris Carson coming off an injury and Rashad Penny now entering a, you know, a contract year. And it took Rashad a few years, but he got it going last year. He had a really nice year for him. But so that's what they want to be. But in terms of team building, you can't be short-sighted. You can't look at like, oh, Charles Cross might struggle in the run game his rookie year. You have to draft the best player. And they felt like Charles Cross, of the tackles that got to them there at the 9th pick, he was the best one. So again, it might not be ideal next year, but you can't just, you're talking about a top 10 pick. You hope Charles Cross is there a decade, right? So yeah, year one might not be ideal, but he's not going to get your quarterback killed in pass pro. You might have to play a little more tight end heavy stuff on the left side to help him out in the run game. But again, you will deal with those growing pains year one to get him going in the run game to get the pass protector right away.
In terms of Abraham Lucas, so he was a 4-year starter at right tackle, correct, at Washington State. That's always an interesting one for me. Now he's getting drafted to go play right tackle, so that's great. You don't need to project whether or not he can flip sides, because right, you're putting him right there. But there are questions that I'm sure will come up about why somebody played right tackle specifically. If he was good enough to play in the NFL, why they didn't put him at left tackle at Washington State?
Well, you know, when he got there, when he started off, they had Andre Dillard there. And Andre played in the Senior Bowl a few years ago. I think it was my first year. I think that probably would have been Abe's freshman year. Dillard was the left tackle. And he ended up being a first round pick for the Philadelphia Eagles. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't talked to those coaches on why they didn't move him. I mean, to me, he's more of an NFL right tackle athlete anyway. So I would be, you know, if you're the Seahawks, I'm happy they didn't move him over. You're getting a guy that's really, really comfortable on that right side. Abe's a really good player. Could he have played left tackle in college? Absolutely. And he would have been a really good college left tackle. But when you're projecting it, I do think he would have been a better NFL right side player. So the thing is with Abe, which you know, maybe gave some teams a little hesitation, was the Pac-12 competition this year. Abe made it look really easy. There was not a lot of good competition out there. The conference as a whole is down a little bit right now from an overall NFL talent perspective. So he didn't see a lot of NFL rushers. I guess Kayvon Thibodeau was probably the best one he faced. And Thibodeau got after Washington State a little bit, but it was over on the left side. He was doing all his damage. It wasn't against Abe. So they got a good player in the third round. Again, he just wasn't tested. He really made it look easy the entire season. I mean, it's, you know, he faced some good people here in Mobile, and I think that's where people got really comfortable. Okay, this guy's an NFL starter, because you saw him against future NFL people. But the Pac-12 tape, it was tough to gauge that.
Well, the USC Trojan in me is very sad about the answer that you just gave there, but I have faith that that's going to change. What about the defensive side of the ball? Anybody jump out at you there?
Yeah. I would say in Baltimore, you know, Baltimore gets lauded every year for their drafts. They do such a good job there, you know, from Ozzie Newsome, now Eric DaCosta, and that's that whole department. They've just done a great job. They just take good football players. It's a real simple formula, right? Just take good players. So they let the draft come to them, and that, well, that really happened. So I think a lot of people going in the first round thought they were targeting Georgia's Jordan Davis, the big nose tackle with the first pick. And then you get there on draft day and Philly jumps ahead of them. And I don't know, like talking to those guys in Baltimore, like I haven't dug in and tried to, you know, unveil their plans and what they were planning to do. But I know a lot of mock draft people thought that's what they were going to do because it only made sense. He would have been a good Haloti Ngata type Raven player. But so they were patient though. They didn't jump. They took Kyle Hamilton and they take Tyler Linderbaum, the center from Iowa. And they just keep taking good football players. And there they are in the third round and they get Travis Jones, who during Senior Bowl week was arguably the best defensive lineman here, bar none. I thought he had a chance of going in the first round. I think, you know, some of the up and down college tape at UConn maybe held people back a little bit. But his week in Mobile, he was dominant. He put people on their heels all week. He's got power. I think he showed down here he can play on all three downs. Like, he has the ability to collapse the pocket, which not a lot of nose tackles have that. Usually when you have some of that third down value as a nose tackle, you are going up in the first couple of rounds. And he lasted to the third. So you look for a fit, a guy that like really feels like a Raven type player. And for them, a guy with a high ceiling, a guy that really feels like he's just trying to just starting to scratch the surface. Really, really powerful man with a lot of first round flashes and starter talent. I mean, this is a guy, he's going to have to compete right away with Michael Pierce, who was a good player for the Ravens for a number of years, went to Minnesota as a free agent, got paid well, didn't really pan out, sat out the COVID year. Now he's back in Baltimore. I think Travis Jones has a really good chance of coming in there and playing right away.
I did his game in 0 week against Fresno State. And I remember the coaches talking about how he was, well, first of all, their best defensive player, but also a guy who had totally redone his body since he got to UConn, that he came in at 360, got down to 328, was like 13% body fat. One of the questions that I know Ravens fans were asking prior to the draft about Jordan Davis, their concerns about whether there was any pass rush that could come from that position. Is that something that you see Travis being able to do?
Absolutely. And I think that was the value of him coming to the Senior Bowl, honestly, like the one-on-one stuff. He put some good players on their heels and he walked some guys back. I mean, Cole Strange, the first round pick, the 29th pick to the Patriots, who I think is going to be a Pro Bowl player over time in New England. I know that I get it that Pats fans were kind of skeptical of a guy coming from Chattanooga. They hadn't heard a lot about him, especially the casual fan. He's a good player. And when you see what Travis Jones did to him on a couple reps, Zion Johnson, who another guy I think's got a chance to go to Pro Bowls, first rounder to the Chargers there in L.A., and what he did to Zion on some reps there. So, and the funny thing is those three guys were all training in Pensacola leading up to the Senior Bowl in the draft. So those guys are all buddies, but no, I think Travis has some really explosive, natural inline power in his body to get people on their heels. And when you're talking about nose, they're not going to be like pretty pass rushers. They're going to be guys that get right into you, knock you back and walk you back and get you in the quarterback's lap. And I think Travis can definitely do that. He certainly showed it here against high-end people. I mean, you're talking about first-round picks. I mean, the Patriots and the Chargers pick those two guys because they see them as Pro Bowl-type players. You draft guys in the first round to be Pro Bowl players. So if Travis can do that against them in one-on-one battles, he certainly has that in his body to be that guy as a pro.
Did I see you tweet recently that next year's wide receiver class is going to be significantly better than this year's wide receiver class?
From a senior standpoint, that's how the board started now. Like, our staff had done some work on that. I'm digging into it. I've lowered, dropped a couple guys on the board since I started watching a couple of these guys. But it's going to be good. It's going to be another strong class. I mean, I just think this receiver position thing, these guys are all playing so much football. It's no secret, all the 7-on-7 stuff and guys in college throwing it around. It just, these guys are so much more ready-made and really so many good athletes out there. But yeah, I expect it to be a good class. I think it's going to be better than, at least senior wise, I think probably a little bit better than this year's class was.
Who's a name that we should be keeping our eye on?
Gosh, I would say Cedric Tillman from Tennessee is probably the best one I've seen so far. And we have a little lineage of Tennessee guys here in Mobile over the last couple of years. Jawan Jennings is doing good stuff in San Francisco. Josh Palmer out in your backyard in LA with the Chargers. And then this year with Bayless, who we talked about. So we could go 4 years in a row. Cedric is big, fast, strong, does it against good people in the SEC, playmaker, has got playmaking ability. So, really exciting player.
Jim, you're the best. I always love picking your brain. So much good stuff comes of it. I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, good to see you, Lindsay. Have a great summer.
Lots more good stuff from Jim on his Twitter feed, where he's already tweeting out clips of 2023 prospects. He posted one of Jalen Cropper from Fresno State this week in a game that I did sideline for, actually. The highlight that he posted was that UConn game that we already mentioned, where Travis Jones played. Hottest game I've ever been to. Literally went to walk to the other side of the field to check on the UConn bench at one point, got about three quarters of the way, and thought I was going to pass out. I literally had to stop and do that, like, hands on your thighs, head down, get your bearings thing. Ended up turning around, going back to the Fresno State side, camping out by the Bulldogs trainer tent, which ended up being where the story was moving forward anyway, as like eight players ended up getting IVs, including, if I remember correctly, Cropper, definitely their quarterback, Jake Haener. Anyways, always love talking to Jim, and I hope that you enjoyed the conversation as well. Big thanks to him and the Ringer's Ben Solak for joining the show this week. Also a big thanks to Andrew Emmer, as always, who produces the show, Marissa Rivas, who is the acting director of sports podcasts for SiriusXM, and Steve Cohen, who is the SiriusXM senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. As always, I would be very grateful if you could hit that subscribe button, maybe a quick tap on that five-star button. Also, if you have a little bit of extra time, a review would be awesome. I'm always open to hear your thoughts on my social media channels as well. Lindsay_Rhodes on Twitter. I'm Lindsay Rhodes NFL on Insta. Got a great guest lined up for next week's show, who has been having a lot of deep conversations these days as the host of The Pivot. You also know him from NFL Live on ESPN, and of course, you know him from his days in Pittsburgh with the Steelers. It is Ryan Clark. I'm very much looking forward to that conversation. I hope you'll join us for that show. In the meantime, I hope you have a great week.
SiriusXM Podcasts.